unnamed meaning of her question.
Where?
The word was almost a command. He hesitated. Then she saw a faint smile that touched only his lips, not his eyes, the kind of smile with which one contemplates, with longing, bitterness, and pride, a possession purchased at an excruciating cost. His eyes seemed directed not at her, but at the girl of that time. Underground. In the Taggart terminal, he answered. She became suddenly conscious of her posture. She had let her shoulder blades slide down against the chair carelessly, half lying, one leg stretched forward, and with her sternly tailored transparent blouse, her wide peasant skirt hand-printed in violent colors, her thin stocking and high-heeled pump, she did not look like a railroad executive. The consciousness of it struck her in answer to his eyes that seemed to be seeing the unattainable. She looked like that which she was, his servant girl. She knew the moment when some faintest stress of the brilliance in his dark green eyes removed the veil of distance, replacing the vision of the past by the act of seeing her immediate person. She met his eyes with that insolent glance which is a smile without movement of facial muscles. He turned away, but as he moved across the room his steps were as eloquent as the sound of a voice. She knew that he wanted to leave the room, as he always left it. He had never stayed for longer than a brief good night when he came home. She watched the course of his struggle, whether by means of his steps, begun in one direction and swerving in another, or by means of her certainty that her body had become an instrument for the direct perception of his, like a screen reflecting both movements and motives. She could not tell. She knew only that he, who had never started or lost a battle against himself, now had no power to leave this room. His manner seemed to show no sign of strain. He took off his coat, throwing it aside, remaining in shirt sleeves, and sat down facing her at the window across the room. But he sat down on the arm of a chair, as if he were neither leaving nor staying. She felt the light-headed, the easy, the almost frivolous sensation of triumph in the knowledge that she was holding him as surely as by a physical touch. For the length of a moment, brief and dangerous to endure, it was a more satisfying form of contact. Then she felt a sudden, blinding shock, which was half blow, half scream within her, and she groped, stunned, for its cause, only to realize that he had leaned a little to one side, and it had been no more than the sight of an accidental posture, of the long line running from his shoulder to the angle of his waist, to his hips, down his legs. She looked away, not to let him see that she was trembling, and she dropped all thoughts of triumph and of whose was the power. "I've seen you many times since," he said quietly, steadily, but a little more slowly than usual, as if he could control everything except his need to speak.
"Where have you seen me?"
"Many places."
"But you made certain to remain unseen."
She knew that his was a face she could not have failed to notice.
"Yes." "Why? Were you afraid?"
"Yes." He said it simply, and it took her a moment to realize that he was admitting he knew what the sight of his person would have meant to her.
"Did you know who I was when you saw me for the first time?"
"Oh, yes. My worst enemy but one."
"What?"
She had not expected it. She added, more quietly,
"Who's the worst one?"
"Dr. Robert Stadler."
"Did you have me classified with him?"
"No. He's my conscious enemy. He's the man who sold his soul. We don't intend to reclaim him."
"You?
You were one of us."
"I knew it, long before I saw you.
I knew also that you would be the last to join us, and the hardest one to defeat."
"Who told you that?"
"Francisco." She let a moment pass, then asked,
"What did he say?"
"He said that of all the names on our list, you'd be the one most difficult to win. That was when I heard of you for the first time. It was Francisco who put your name on our list. He told me that you were the sole hope and future of Taggart Transcontinental, that you'd stand against us for a long time, that you'd fight a desperate battle for your railroad, because you had too much endurance, courage, and consecration to your work. He glanced at her. He told me nothing else. He spoke of you as if he were merely discussing one of our future strikers. I knew that you and he had been childhood friends. That was all.
When did you see me?
2 years later.
How?
By chance. It was late at night, on a passenger platform of the Taggart terminal. She knew that this was a form of surrender. He did not want to say it, yet he had to speak. She heard both the muted intensity and the pull of resistance in his voice. He had to speak, because he had to give himself and her this one form of contact. You wore an evening gown. You had a cape half slipping off your body. I saw at first only your bare shoulders, your back, and your profile. It looked for a moment as if the cape would slip further and you would stand there naked. Then I saw that you wore a long gown, the color of ice, like the tunic of a Grecian goddess, but had the short hair and the imperious profile of an American woman. You looked preposterously out of place on a railroad platform, and it was not on a railroad platform that I was seeing you. I was seeing a setting that had never haunted me before. But then, suddenly, I knew that you did belong among the rails, the soot, and the girders, that that was the proper setting for a flowing gown and naked shoulders and a face as alive as yours. A railroad platform, not a curtained apartment. You looked like a symbol of luxury, and you belonged in the place that was its source. You seemed to bring wealth, grace, extravagance, and the enjoyment of life back to their rightful owners, to the men who created railroads and factories. You had a look of energy and of its reward together, a look of competence and luxury combined. And I was the first man who had ever stated in what manner these two were inseparable. And I thought that if our age gave form to its proper gods and erected a statue to the meaning of an American railroad, yours would be that statue. Then I saw what you were doing, and I knew who you were. You were giving orders to 3 terminal officials. I could not hear your words, but your voice sounded swift, clear-cut, and confident. I knew that you were Dagny Taggart. I came closer, close enough to hear 2 sentences. "Who said so?" asked one of the men. "I did," you answered. That was all I heard. That was enough. And then? He raised his eyes slowly to hold hers across the room, and the submerged intensity that pulled his voice down, blurring its tone to softness, gave it a sound of self-mockery that was desperate and almost gentle. Then I knew that abandoning my motor was not the hardest price I would have to pay for this strike. She wondered which anonymous shadow, among the passengers who had hurried past her, as insubstantial as the steam of the engines and as ignored, which shadow and face had been his. She wondered how close she had come to him for the length of that unknown moment.
"Oh, why didn't you speak to me then or later?"
"Do you happen to remember what you were doing in the terminal that night?"
"I remember vaguely a night when they called me from some party I was attending. My father was out of town, and the new terminal manager had made some sort of error that tied up all traffic in the tunnels. The old manager had quit unexpectedly the week before."
"It was I who made him quit."
"I see."
Her voice trailed off, as if abandoning sound, as her eyelids dropped, abandoning sight. If he had not withstood it then, she thought, if he had come to claim her then or later, what sort of tragedy would they have had to reach? She remembered what she had felt when she had cried that she would shoot the destroyer on sight.
"I would have."
The thought was not in words. She knew it only as a trembling pressure in her stomach.
"I would have shot him afterward if I discovered his role, and I would have had to discover it. And yet,"
she shuddered, because she knew she still wished he had come to her, because the thought not to be admitted into her mind, but flowing as a dark warmth through her body was, "I would have shot him, but not before." She raised her eyelids, and she knew that that thought was as naked to him in her eyes as it was to her in his. She saw his veiled glance and the tautness of his mouth. She saw him reduced to agony. She felt herself drowned by the exultant wish to cause him pain, to see it, to watch it beyond her own endurance and his, then to reduce him to the helplessness of pleasure. He got up, he looked away, and she could not tell whether it was the slight lift of his head or the tension of his features that made his face look oddly calm and clear, as if it were stripped of emotion down to the naked purity of its structure. "Every man that your railroad needed and lost in the past 10 years," he said, "it was I who made you lose him." His voice had the single-toned flatness and the luminous simplicity of an accountant who reminds a reckless purchaser that cost is an absolute which cannot be escaped. "I have pulled every girder from under Taggart Transcontinental, and if you choose to go back, I will see it collapse upon your head." He turned to leave the room. She stopped him. It was her voice, more than her words, that made him stop. Her voice was low. It had no quality of emotion, only of a sinking weight, and its sole color was some dragging undertone, like an inner echo resembling a threat. It was the voice of the plea of a person who still retains a concept of honor, but is long past caring for it. "You want to hold me here, don't you? More than anything else in the world. You could hold me." "I know it." His voice had said it with the same sound as hers. He waited to regain his breath. When he spoke, his voice was low and clear, with some stressed quality of awareness, which was almost the quality of a smile of understanding. "It's your acceptance of this place that I want. What good would it do me to have your physical presence without any meaning? That's the kind of faked reality by which most people cheat themselves of their lives. I'm not capable of it." He turned to go. "And neither are you. Good night, Miss Taggart." He walked out into his bedroom, closing the door. She was past the realm of thought, as she lay in bed in the darkness of her room, unable to think or to sleep. And the moaning violence that filled her mind seemed only a sensation of her muscles, but its tone and its twisting shades were like a pleading cry, which she knew not as words but as pain. "Let him come here. Let him break. Let it be damned, all of it, my railroad and his strike and everything we've lived by. Let it be damned, everything we've been and are. He would, if tomorrow I were to die. Then let me die, but tomorrow let him come here, be at any price he names. I have nothing left that's not for sale to him any longer. Is this what it means to be an animal? It does, and I am." She lay on her back, her palms pressed to the sheet at her sides, to stop herself from rising and walking into his room, knowing that she was capable even of that. "It's not I. It's a body I can neither endure nor control." But somewhere within her, not as words, but as a radiant point of stillness, there was the presence of the judge who seemed to observe her, not in stern condemnation any longer, but in approval and amusement, as if saying, "Your body? If he were not what you know him to be, would your body bring you to this? Why is it his body that you want and no other? Do you think that you are damning them, the things you both have lived by? Are you damning that which you are honoring in this very moment by your very desire?" She did not have to hear the words. She knew them. She had always known them. After a while she lost the glow of that knowledge, and there was nothing left but pain and the palms that were pressed to the sheet, and the almost indifferent wonder whether he too was awake and fighting the same torture. She heard no sound in the house and saw no light from his window on the tree trunks outside. After a long while, she heard, from the darkness of his room, two sounds that gave her a full answer. She knew that he was awake and that he would not come. It was the sound of a step and the click of a cigarette lighter. Richard Halley stopped playing, turned away from the piano, and glanced at Dagny. He saw her drop her face with the involuntary movement of hiding too strong an emotion. He rose, smiled, and said softly, "Thank you." "Oh, no," she whispered, knowing that the gratitude was hers and that it was futile to express it. She was thinking of the years when the works he had just played for her were being written, here, in his small cottage on a ledge of the valley, when all this prodigal magnificence of sound was being shaped by him as a flowing monument to a concept which equates the sense of life with the sense of beauty. While she had walked through the streets of New York in a hopeless quest for some form of enjoyment, with the screeches of a modern symphony running after her as if spit by the infected throat of a loudspeaker, coughing its malicious hatred of existence. "But I mean it," said Richard Halley, smiling. "I'm a businessman, and I never do anything without payment. You've paid me. Do you see why I wanted to play for you tonight?" She raised her head. He stood in the middle of his living room. They were alone, with a window open to the summer night, to the dark trees on a long sweep of ledges descending toward the glitter of the valley's distant lights. "Miss Taggart, how many people are there to whom my work means as much as it does to you?" "Not many," she answered simply, neither as boast nor flattery, but as an impersonal tribute to the exacting values involved. "That is the payment I demand. Not many can afford it. I don't mean your enjoyment. I don't mean your emotion. Emotions be damned. I mean your understanding and the fact that your enjoyment was of the same nature as mine, that it came from the same source, from your intelligence, from the conscious judgment of a mind able to judge my work by the standard of the same values that went to write it. I mean, not the fact that you felt, but that you felt what I wished you to feel. Not the fact that you admire my work, but that you admire it for the things I wished to be admired." He chuckled. "There's only one passion in most artists more violent than their desire for admiration. Their fear of identifying the nature of such admiration as they do receive. But it's a fear I've never shared. I do not fool myself about my work or the response I seek. I value both too highly. I do not care to be admired causelessly, emotionally, intuitively, instinctively, or blindly. I do not care for blindness in any form. I have too much to show. Or for deafness. I have too much to say. I do not care to be admired by anyone's heart, only by someone's head. And when I find a customer with that invaluable capacity, then my performance is a mutual trade to mutual profit. An artist is a trader, Miss Taggart, the hardest and most exacting of all traders. Now do you understand me?"
"Yes," she said incredulously. "I do."
Incredulously because she was hearing her own symbol of moral pride, chosen by a man she had least expected to choose it. "If you do, why did you look quite so tragic just a moment ago? What is it that you regret? The years when your work has remained unheard." "But it hasn't. I've given 2 or 3 concerts every year. Here, in Galt's Gulch. I am giving 1 next week. I hope you'll come. The price of admission is 25 cents. She could not help laughing. He smiled. Then his face slipped slowly into earnestness, as under the tide of some unspoken contemplation of his own. He looked at the darkness beyond the window, at a spot where, in a clearing of the branches, with the moonlight draining its color, leaving only its metallic luster, the sign of the dollar hung like a curve of shining steel engraved on the sky. "Miss Taggart, do you see why I'd give 3 dozen modern artists for 1 real businessman? Why I have much more in common with Ellis Wyatt or Ken Daniger who happens to be tone-deaf, than with men like Mort Liddy and Balf Eubank. Whether it's a symphony or a coal mine, all work is an act of creating and comes from the same source, from an inviolate capacity to see through one's own eyes, which means the capacity to perform a rational identification, which means the capacity to see, to connect, and to make what had not been seen, connected, and made before. That shining vision which they talk about as belonging to the authors of symphonies and novels, what do they think is the driving faculty of men who discover how to use oil, how to run a mine, how to build an electric motor? That sacred fire which is said to burn within musicians and poets, what do they suppose moves an industrialist to defy the whole world for the sake of his new metal, as the inventors of the airplane, the builders of the railroads, the discoverers of new germs or new continents have done through all the ages? An intransigent devotion to the pursuit of truth, Miss Taggart? Have you heard the moralists and the art lovers of the centuries talk about the artist's intransigent devotion to the pursuit of truth? Name me a greater example of such devotion than the act of a man who says that the earth does turn, or the act of a man who says that an alloy of steel and copper has certain properties which enable it to do certain things, that it is and does. And let the world rack him or ruin him, he will not bear false witness to the evidence of his mind. This, Miss Taggart, this sort of spirit, courage, and love for truth, as against a sloppy bum who goes around proudly assuring you that he has almost reached the perfection of a lunatic, because he's an artist who hasn't the faintest idea what his artwork is or means. He's not restrained by such crude concepts as being or meaning. He's the vehicle of higher mysteries. He doesn't know how he created his work or why. It just came out of him spontaneously, like vomit out of a drunkard. He did not think. He wouldn't stoop to thinking. He just felt it. All he has to do is feel. He feels. The flabby, loose-mouthed, shifty-eyed, drooling, shivering, uncongealed bastard. I, who know what discipline, what effort, what tension of mind, what unrelenting strain upon one's power of clarity are needed to produce a work of art. I, who know that it requires a labor which makes a chain gang look like rest and a severity no army drilling sadist could impose. I'll take the operator of a coal mine over any walking vehicle of higher mysteries. The operator knows that it's not his feelings that keep the coal carts moving under the earth. And he knows what does keep them moving. Feelings? Oh, yes, we do feel, he, you, and I. We are, in fact, the only people capable of feeling. And we know where our feelings come from. But what we did not know, and have delayed learning for too long, is the nature of those who claim that they cannot account for their feelings. We did not know what it is that they feel. We are learning it now. It was a costly error, and those most guilty of it will pay the hardest price, as, in justice, they must. Those most guilty of it were the real artists, who will now see that they are first to be exterminated, and that they had prepared the triumph of their own exterminators by helping to destroy their only protectors. For if there is more tragic a fool than the businessman who doesn't know that he's an exponent of man's highest creative spirit, it's the artist who thinks that the businessman is his enemy. It was true, she thought, when she walked through the streets of the valley, looking with a child's excitement at the shop windows sparkling in the sun, that the businesses here had the purposeful selectiveness of art, and that the art, she thought, when she sat in the darkness of a clabbered concert hall, listening to the controlled violence and the mathematical precision of Halley's music, had the stern discipline of business. Both had the radiance of engineering, she thought, when she sat among rows of benches under the open sky, watching Kay Ludlow on the stage. It was an experience she had not known since childhood, the experience of being held for 3 hours by a play that told a story she had not seen before, in lines she had not heard, uttering a theme that had not been picked from the hand-me-downs of the centuries. It was the forgotten delight of being held in rapt attention by the reins of the ingenious, the unexpected, the logical, the purposeful, the new, and of seeing it embodied in a performance of superlative artistry by a woman playing a character whose beauty of spirit matched her own physical perfection.
"That's why I'm here, Miss Taggart,"
said Kay Ludlow, smiling in answer to her comment after the performance.
"Whatever quality of human greatness I have the talent to portray, that was the quality the outer world sought to degrade. They let me play nothing but symbols of depravity, nothing but harlots, dissipation chasers, and home wreckers, always to be beaten at the end by the little girl next door, personifying the virtue of mediocrity. They used my talent for the defamation of itself. That was why I quit."
Not since childhood, thought Dagny, had she felt that sense of exhilaration after witnessing the performance of a play. The sense that life held things worth reaching, not the sense of having studied some aspect of a sewer there had been no reason to see. As the audience filed away into the darkness from the lighted rows of benches, she noticed Ellis Wyatt, Judge Narragansett, Ken Daniger, men who had once been said to despise all forms of art. The last image she caught that evening was the sight of two tall, straight, slender figures walking away together down a trail among the rocks, with the beam of a spotlight flashing once on the gold of their hair. They were Kay Ludlow and Ragnar Danneskiold, and she wondered whether she could bear to return to a world where these were the two doomed to destruction. The recaptured sense of her own childhood kept coming back to her whenever she met the two sons of the young woman who owned the bakery shop. She often saw them wandering down the trails of the valley, two fearless beings, aged 7 and 4. They seemed to face life as she had faced it. They did not have the look she had seen in the children of the outer world, a look of fear, half secretive, half sneering, the look of a child's defense against an adult, the look of a being in the process of discovering that he is hearing lies and of learning to feel hatred. The two boys had the open, joyous, friendly confidence of kittens who do not expect to get hurt. They had an innocently natural, non-boastful sense of their own value, and as innocent a trust in any stranger's ability to recognize it. They had the eager curiosity that would venture anywhere with a certainty that life held nothing unworthy of or closed to discovery. And they looked as if, should they encounter malevolence, they would reject it contemptuously, not as dangerous, but as stupid. They would not accept it in bruised resignation as the law of existence.
"They represent my particular career, Miss Taggart," said the young mother in answer to her comment, wrapping a loaf of fresh bread and smiling at her across the counter. "They're the profession I've chosen to practice, which, in spite of all the guff about motherhood, one can't practice successfully in the outer world. I believe you've met my husband. He's the teacher of economics who works as linesman for Dick McNamara. You know, of course, that there can be no collective commitments in this valley, and that families or relatives are not allowed to come here unless each person takes the striker's oath by his own independent conviction. I came here, not merely for the sake of my husband's profession, but for the sake of my own. I came here in order to bring up my sons as human beings. I would not surrender them to the educational systems devised to stunt a child's brain, to convince him that reason is impotent, that existence is an irrational chaos with which he's unable to deal, and thus reduce him to a state of chronic terror. You marvel at the difference between my children and those outside, Miss Taggart? Yet the cause is so simple. The cause is that here, in Galt's Gulch, there's no person who would not consider it monstrous ever to confront a child with the slightest suggestion of the irrational."
She thought of the teachers whom the schools of the world had lost, when she looked at the three pupils of Dr. Axton on the evening of their yearly reunion. The only other guest he had invited was Kay Ludlow. The six of them sat in the backyard of his house, with the light of the sunset on their faces and the floor of the valley condensing into a soft blue vapor far below. She looked at his pupils, at the three pliant, agile figures half-stretched on canvas chairs in poses of relaxed contentment, dressed in slacks, windbreakers, and open-collared shirts. John Galt, Francisco D'Anconia, Ragnar Danneskiold.
"Don't be astonished, Miss Taggart," said Dr. Axton, smiling. "And don't make the mistake of thinking that these three pupils of mine are some sort of superhuman creatures. There's something much greater and more astounding than that. They're normal men, a thing the world has never seen, and their feat is that they manage to survive as such. It does take an exceptional mind and a still more exceptional integrity to remain untouched by the brain-destroying influences of the world's doctrines, the accumulated evil of centuries, to remain human, since the human is the rational." She felt some new quality in Dr. Axton's attitude, some change in the sternness of his usual reserve. He seemed to include her in their circle, as if she were more than a guest. Francisco acted as if her presence at their reunion were natural and to be taken gaily for granted. Galt's face gave no hint of any reaction. His manner was that of a courteous escort who had brought her here at Dr. Axton's request. She noticed that Dr. Axton's eyes kept coming back to her, as if with the quiet pride of displaying his students to an appreciative observer. His conversation kept returning to a single theme, in the manner of a father who has found a listener interested in his most cherished subject. "You should have seen them when they were in college, Miss Taggart. You couldn't have found three boys conditioned to such different backgrounds, but conditioners be damned. They must have picked one another at first sight among the thousands on that campus. Francisco, the richest heir in the world. Ragnar, the European aristocrat. And Jean, the self-made man. Self-made in every sense, out of nowhere. Penniless, parentless, tieless. Actually, he was the son of a gas station mechanic at some forsaken crossroads in Ohio, and he had left home at the age of 12 to make his own way. But I've always thought of him as if he had come into the world like Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, who sprang forth from Jupiter's head fully grown and fully armed. I remember the day when I saw the three of them for the first time. They were sitting at the back of the classroom. I was giving a special course for postgraduate students, so difficult a course that few outsiders ever ventured to attend these particular lectures. Those three looked too young even for freshmen. They were 16 at the time, as I learned later. At the end of that lecture, John got up to ask me a question. It was a question which, as a teacher, I would have been proud to hear from a student who'd taken 6 years of philosophy. It was a question pertaining to Plato's metaphysics, which Plato hadn't had the sense to ask of himself. I answered, and I asked John to come to my office after the lecture. He came. All three of them came. I saw the two others in my anteroom and let them in. I talked to them for an hour. Then I canceled all my appointments and talked to them for the rest of the day. After which I arranged to let them take that course and receive their credits for it. They took the course. They got the highest grades in the class. They were majoring in two subjects, physics and philosophy. Their choice amazed everybody but me. Modern thinkers considered it unnecessary to perceive reality, and modern physicists considered it unnecessary to think. I knew better. What amazed me was that these children knew it too. Robert Stadler was the head of the Department of Physics, as I was head of the Department of Philosophy. He and I suspended all rules and restrictions for these three students. We spared them all the routine, unessential courses. We loaded them with nothing but the hardest tasks, and we cleared their way to major in our two subjects within their 4 years. They worked for it. And during those 4 years, they worked for their living besides.
Francisco and Ragnar were receiving allowances from their parents. John had nothing, but all three of them held part-time jobs to earn their own experience and money. Francisco worked in a copper foundry. John worked in a railroad roundhouse, and Ragnar... No, Miss Taggart, Ragnar was not the least, but the most studiously sedate of the three. He worked as clerk in the university library. They had time for everything they wanted, but no time for people or for any communal campus activities. They... Ragnar, he interrupted himself suddenly, sharply. Don't sit on the ground. Daniskjold had slipped down and was now sitting on the grass, with his head leaning against Kay Ludlow's knees. He rose obediently, chuckling. Dr. Axton smiled with a touch of apology. It's an old habit of mine, he explained to Dagny. A conditioned reflex, I guess. I used to tell him that in those college years when I'd catch him sitting on the ground in my backyard on cold, foggy evenings. He was reckless that way. He made me worry. He should have known it was dangerous, and... He stopped abruptly. He read in Dagny's startled eyes the same thought as his own. The thought of the kind of dangers the adult Ragnar had chosen to face. Dr. Axton shrugged, spreading his hands in a gesture of helpless self-mockery. Kay Ludlow smiled at him in understanding. My house stood just outside the campus, he continued, sighing, on a tall bluff over Lake Erie. We spent many evenings together, the four of us. We would sit just like this in my backyard, on the nights of early fall or in the spring, only instead of this granite mountainside, we had the spread of the lake before us, stretching off into a peacefully unlimited distance. I had to work harder on those nights than in any classroom, answering all the questions they'd ask me, discussing the kind of issues they'd raise. About midnight, I would fix some hot chocolate and force them to drink it. The one thing I suspected was that they never took time to eat properly. And then we'd go on talking, while the lake vanished into solid darkness and the sky seemed lighter than the earth. There were a few times when we stayed there till I noticed suddenly that the sky was turning darker and the lake was growing pale and we were within a few sentences of daylight. I should have known better. I knew that they weren't getting enough sleep as it was, but I forgot it occasionally. I lost my sense of time. You see, when they were there, I always felt as if it were early morning and a long, inexhaustible day were stretching ahead before us. They never spoke of what they wished they might do in the future. They never wondered whether some mysterious omnipotence had favored them with some unknowable talent to achieve the things they wanted. They spoke of what they would do. Does affection tend to make one a coward? I know that the only times I felt fear were occasional moments when I listened to them and thought of what the world was becoming and what they would have to encounter in the future. Fear? Yes, but it was more than fear. It was the kind of emotion that makes men capable of killing. When I thought that the purpose of the world's trend was to destroy these children, that these three sons of mine were marked for immolation. Oh yes, I would have killed. But whom was there to kill? It was everyone and no one. There was no single enemy. No center and no villain. It was not the simpering social worker incapable of earning a penny or the thieving bureaucrat scared of his own shadow. It was the whole of the earth rolling into an obscenity of horror, pushed by the hand of every would-be decent man who believed that need is holier than ability and pity is holier than justice. But these were only occasional moments. It was not my constant feeling. I listened to my children, and I knew that nothing would defeat them. I looked at them as they sat in my backyard, and beyond my house there were the tall, dark buildings of what was still a monument to unenslaved thought, the Patrick Henry University. And farther in the distance there were the lights of Cleveland, the orange glow of steel mills behind batteries of smokestacks, the twinkling red dots of radio towers, the long white rays of airports on the black edge of the sky.
and I thought that in the name of any greatness that had ever existed and moved this world, the greatness of which they were the last descendants, they would win. I remember one night when I noticed that John had been silent for a long time, and I saw that he had fallen asleep, stretched there on the ground. The two others confessed that he had not slept for 3 days. I sent the two of them home at once, but I didn't have the heart to disturb him. It was a warm spring night. I brought a blanket to cover him, and I let him sleep where he was. I sat there beside him till morning, and as I watched his face in the starlight, then the first ray of the sun on his untroubled forehead and closed eyelids, what I experienced was not a prayer. I do not pray, but that state of spirit at which a prayer is a misguided attempt, a full, confident, affirming self-dedication to my love of the right, to the certainty that the right would win and that this boy would have the kind of future he deserved. He moved his arm, pointing to the valley. I did not expect it to be as great as this, or as hard. It had grown dark and the mountains had blended with the sky. Hanging detached in space, there were the lights of the valley below them, the red breath of Stockton's foundry above, and the lighted string of windows of Mulligan's house, like a railroad car embedded in the sky. "I did have a rival," said Dr. Axton slowly. "It was Robert Stadler." "Don't frown, John. It's past. John did love him once." "Well, so did I." "No, not quite, but what one felt for a mind like Stadler's was painfully close to love. It was that rarest of pleasures. Admiration. No, I did not love him, but he and I had always felt as if we were fellow survivors from some vanishing age or land in the gibbering swamp of mediocrity around us. The mortal sin of Robert Stadler was that he never identified his proper homeland. He hated stupidity. It was the only emotion I had ever seen him display toward people. A biting, bitter, weary hatred for any ineptitude that dared to oppose him. He wanted his own way. He wanted to be left alone to pursue it. He wanted to brush people out of his path. And he never identified the means to it or the nature of his path and of his enemies. He took a short cut. Are you smiling, Miss Taggart? You hate him, don't you? Yes, you know the kind of shortcut he took. He told you that we were rivals for these 3 students. That was true. Or rather, that was not the way I thought of it, but I knew that he did. Well, if we were rivals, I had one advantage. I knew why they needed both our professions. He never understood their interest in mine. He never understood its importance to himself, which incidentally is what destroyed him. But in those years he was still alive enough to grasp at these 3 students. Grasp was the word for it. Intelligence being the only value he worshipped, he clutched them as if they were a private treasure of his own. He had always been a very lonely man. I think that in the whole of his life, Francisco and Ragnar were his only love, and John was his only passion. It was John whom he regarded as his particular heir, as his future, as his own immortality. John intended to be an inventor, which meant that he was to be a physicist. He was to take his postgraduate course under Robert Stadler. Francisco intended to leave after graduation and go to work. He was to be the perfect blend of both of us, his 2 intellectual fathers, an industrialist. And Ragnar. You didn't know what profession Ragnar had chosen, Miss Taggart? No, it wasn't stunt pilot or jungle explorer or deep sea diver. It was something much more courageous than these. Ragnar intended to be a philosopher. An abstract, theoretical, academic, cloistered, ivory tower philosopher. Yes, Robert Stadler loved them. And yet, I have said that I would have killed to protect them, only there was no one to kill.
If that were the solution, which of course it isn't, the man to kill was Robert Stadler. Of any one person, of any single guilt for the evil which is now destroying the world, his was the heaviest guilt. He had the mind to know better. His was the only name of honor and achievement used to sanction the rule of the looters. He was the man who delivered science into the power of the looters' guns. John did not expect it. Neither did I. John came back for his postgraduate course in physics. But he did not finish it. He left on the day when Robert Stadler endorsed the establishment of a state science institute. I met Stadler by chance in a corridor of the university as he came out of his office after his last conversation with John. He looked changed. I hope that I shall never have to see again a change of that kind in a man's face. He saw me approaching, and he did not know, but I knew, what made him whirl upon me and cry, "I'm so sick of all of you impractical idealists." I turned away. I knew that I had heard a man pronounce a death sentence upon himself. "Miss Taggart, do you remember the question you asked me about my three pupils?" "Yes," she whispered. "I could gather from your question the nature of what Robert Stadler had said to you about them. Tell me, why did he speak of them at all?" He saw the faint movement of her bitter smile. "He told me their story as a justification for his belief in the futility of human intelligence. He told it to me as an example of his disillusioned hope. Theirs was the kind of ability, he said, one expects to see in the future changing the course of the world." "Well, haven't they done so?" She nodded slowly, holding her head inclined for a long moment in acquiescence and in homage. "What I want you to understand, Miss Taggart, is the full evil of those who claim to have become convinced that this earth, by its nature, is a realm of malevolence where the good has no chance to win. Let them check their premises. Let them check their standards of value. Let them check, before they grant themselves the unspeakable license of evil as necessity, whether they know what is the good and what are the conditions it requires. Robert Stadler now believes that intelligence is futile and that human life can be nothing but irrational. Did he expect John Galt to become a great scientist, willing to work under the orders of Dr. Floyd Ferris? Did he expect Francisco D'Anconia to become a great industrialist, willing to produce under the orders and for the benefit of Wesley Mouch? Did he expect Ragnar Danneskiold to become a great philosopher, willing to preach under the orders of Dr. Simon Pritchett that there is no mind and that might is right? Would that have been a future which Robert Stadler would have considered rational? I want you to observe, Miss Taggart, that those who cry the loudest about their disillusionment, about the failure of virtue, the futility of reason, the impotence of logic, are those who have achieved the full, exact, logical result of the ideas they preached, so mercilessly logical that they dare not identify it. In a world that proclaims the non-existence of the mind, the moral righteousness of rule by brute force, the penalizing of the competent in favor of the incompetent, the sacrifice of the best to the worst. In such a world, the best have to turn against society and have to become its deadliest enemies. In such a world, John Galt, the man of incalculable intellectual power, will remain an unskilled laborer. Francisco D'Anconia, the miraculous producer of wealth, will become a wastrel. And Ragnar Danneskiold, the man of enlightenment, will become the man of violence. Society and Dr. Robert Stadler have achieved everything they advocated. What complaint do they now have to make? That the universe is irrational? Is it?" He smiled. His smile had the pitiless gentleness of certainty. "Every man builds his world in his own image," he said. He has the power to choose, but no power to escape the necessity of choice. If he abdicates his power, he abdicates the status of man, and the grinding chaos of the irrational is what he achieves as his sphere of existence, by his own choice. Whoever preserves a single thought uncorrupted by any concession to the will of others, whoever brings into reality a matchstick or a patch of garden made in the image of his thought, he, and to that extent, is a man, and that extent is the sole measure of his virtue. They, he pointed at his pupils, made no concessions. This, he pointed at the valley, is the measure of what they preserved and of what they are. Now I can repeat my answer to the question you asked me, knowing that you will understand it fully. You asked me whether I was proud of the way my three sons had turned out. I am more proud than I had ever hoped to be. I am proud of their every action, of their every goal, and of every value they've chosen. And this, Dagny, is my full answer. The sudden sound of her first name was pronounced in the tone of a father. He spoke his last two sentences, looking not at her, but at Galt. She saw Galt answering him by an open glance held steady for an instant, like a signal of affirmation. Then Galt's eyes moved to hers. She saw him looking at her as if she bore the unspoken title that hung in the silence between them, the title Dr. Axton had granted her but had not pronounced and none of the others had caught. She saw, in Galt's eyes, a glance of amusement at her shock, of support, and incredibly, of tenderness. Danconia Copper Number 1 was a small cut on the face of the mountain that looked as if a knife had made a few angular slashes, leaving shelves of rock, red as a wound, on the reddish-brown flank. The sun beat down upon it. Dagny stood at the edge of a path, holding on to Galt's arm on one side and to Francisco's on the other, the wind blowing against their faces and out over the valley, 2,000 feet below. This, she thought, looking at the mine, was the story of human wealth written across the mountains. A few pine trees hung over the cut, contorted by the storms that had raged through the wilderness for centuries. 6 men worked on the shelves, and an inordinate amount of complex machinery traced delicate lines against the sky. The machinery did most of the work. She noticed that Francisco was displaying his domain to Galt as much as to her, as much or more. "You haven't seen it since last year, John." "John, wait till you see it a year from now. I'll be through outside in just a few months. And then this will be my full-time job." "Hell no, John," he said, laughing in answer to a question. But she caught suddenly the particular quality of his glance whenever it rested on Galt. It was the quality she had seen in his eyes when he had stood in her room, clutching the edge of a table to outlive an unlivable moment. He had looked as if he were seeing someone before him. It was Galt, she thought. It was Galt's image that had carried him through. Some part of her felt a dim dread. The effort which Francisco had made in that moment to accept her loss and his rival, as the payment demanded of him for his battle, had cost him so much that he was now unable to suspect the truth Dr. Axton had guessed. "What will it do to him when he learns?" she wondered, and felt a bitter voice reminding her that there would perhaps never be any truth of this kind to learn. Some part of her felt a dim tension as she watched the way Galt looked at Francisco. It was an open, simple, unreserved glance of surrender to an unreserved feeling. She felt the anxious wonder she had never fully named or dismissed. Wonder whether this feeling would bring him down to the ugliness of renunciation. But most of her mind seemed swept by some enormous sense of release, as if she were laughing at all doubts. Her glance kept going back over the path they had traveled to get here, over the 2 exhausting miles of a twisted trail that ran, like a precarious corkscrew, from the tip of her feet down to the floor of the valley. Her eyes kept studying it, her mind racing with some purpose of its own. Brush, pines, and a clinging carpet of moss went climbing from the green slopes far below, up the granite ledges. The moss and the brush vanished gradually, but the pines went on, struggling upward in thinning strands, till only a few dots of single trees were left, rising up the naked rock toward the white sunbursts of snow in the crevices at the peaks. She looked at the spectacle of the most ingenious mining machinery she had ever seen, then at the trail where the plodding hoofs and swaying shapes of mules provided the most ancient form of transportation.
"Francisco," she asked, pointing, "who designed the machines?"
"They're just adaptations of standard equipment."
"Who designed them?"
"I did. We don't have many men to spare. We had to make up for it."
"You're wasting an unconscionable amount of manpower and time carting your ore on muleback. You ought to build a railroad down to the valley."
She was looking down and did not notice the sudden, eager shot of his glance to her face or the sound of caution in his voice. "I know it, but it's such a difficult job that the mine's output won't justify it at present."
"Nonsense. It's much simpler than it looks. There's a pass to the east where there's an easier grade and softer stone. I watched it on the way up. It wouldn't take so many curves. 3 miles of rail or less would do it."
She was pointing east. She did not notice the intensity with which the two men were watching her face.
"Just a narrow-gauge track is all you'll need, like the first railroads. That's where the first railroads started, at mines, only they were coal mines. Look, do you see that ridge? There's plenty of clearance for a 3-foot gauge. You wouldn't need to do any blasting or whitening. Do you see where there's a slow rise for a stretch of almost half a mile? That would be no worse than a 4% grade. Any engine could manage it."
She was speaking with a swift, bright certainty, conscious of nothing but the joy of performing her natural function in her natural world, where nothing could take precedence over the act of offering a solution to a problem.
"The road will pay for itself within 3 years. I think, at rough glance, that the costliest part of the job will be a couple of steel trestles. And there's one spot where I might have to blast a tunnel, but it's only for 100 feet or less. I'll need a steel trestle to throw the track across that gorge and bring it here, but it's not as hard as it looks. Let me show you. Have you got a piece of paper?"
She did not notice with what speed Galt produced a notebook and a pencil and thrust them into her hands. She seized them, as if she expected them to be there, as if she were giving orders on a construction site where details of this kind were not to delay her.
"Let me give you a rough idea of what I mean. If we drive diagonal piles into the rock,"
she was sketching rapidly,
"the actual steel span would be only 600 feet long. It would cut off this last half mile of your corkscrew turns. I could have the rail laid in 3 months and—"
She stopped. When she looked up at their faces, the fire had gone out of hers. She crumpled her sketch and flung it aside into the red dust of the gravel.
"Oh, what for?" she cried, the despair breaking out for the first time. "To build 3 miles of railroad and abandon a transcontinental system."
The two men were looking at her. She saw no reproach in their faces, only a look of understanding which was almost compassion.
"I'm sorry," she said quietly, dropping her eyes. "If you change your mind," said Francisco, "I'll hire you on the spot. What Midas will give you a loan in 5 minutes to finance that railroad, if you want to own it yourself."
She shook her head.
"I can't," she whispered. "Not yet."
She raised her eyes, knowing that they knew the nature of her despair and that it was useless to hide her struggle.
"I've tried it once," she said. "I've tried to give it up. I know what it will mean. I'll think of it with every cross tie I'll see laid here, with every spike driven. I'll think of that other tunnel and of Nat Taggart's bridge. Oh, if only I didn't have to hear about it. If only I could stay here and never know what they're doing to the railroad and never learn when it goes."
"You'll have to hear about it," said Galt. It was that ruthless tone, peculiarly his, which sounded implacable by being simple, devoid of any emotional value save the quality of respect for facts. "You'll hear the whole course of the last agony of Taggart Transcontinental. You'll hear about every wreck. You'll hear about every discontinued train. You'll hear about every abandoned line. you'll hear about the collapse of the Taggart Bridge. Nobody stays in this valley except by a full, conscious choice, based on a full, conscious knowledge of every fact involved in his decision. Nobody stays here by faking reality in any manner whatever. She looked at him, her head lifted, knowing what chance he was rejecting. She thought that no man of the outer world would have said this to her at this moment. She thought of the world's code that worshipped white lies as an act of mercy. She felt a stab of revulsion against that code, suddenly seeing its full ugliness for the first time. She felt an enormous pride for the tight, clean face of the man before her. He saw the shape of her mouth drawn firm in self-control, yet softened by some tremulous emotion, while she answered quietly, "Thank you. You're right." "You don't have to answer me now," he said. "You'll tell me when you've decided. There's still a week left." "Yes," she said calmly. "Just one more week." He turned, picked up her crumpled sketch, folded it neatly, and slipped it into his pocket. "Dagny," said Francisco, "when you weigh your decision, consider the first time you quit, if you wish, but consider everything about it. In this valley, you won't have to torture yourself by shingling roofs and building paths that lead nowhere." "Tell me," she asked suddenly, "how did you find out where I was that time?" He smiled. "It was John who told me. The destroyer, remember? You wondered why the destroyer had not sent anyone after you. But he had. It was he who sent me there."
"He sent you?"
"Yes."
"What did he say to you?"
"Nothing much." "Why?"
"What did he say? Do you remember the exact words?"
"Yes, I do remember. He said, 'If you want your chance, take it. You've earned it.' I remember because—" He turned to Gault with the untroubled frown of a slight casual puzzle.
"John, I never quite understood why you said it. Why that? Why my chance?
Do you mind if I don't answer you now?"
"No, but—"
Someone hailed him from the ledges of the mine, and he went off swiftly, as if the subject required no further attention. She was conscious of the long span of moments she took while turning her head to Gault. She knew that she would find him looking at her. She could read nothing in his eyes except a hint of derision, as if he knew what answer she was seeking and that she would not find it in his face.
"You gave him a chance that you wanted?"
"I could have no chance till he'd had every chance possible to him."
"How did you know what he had earned?"
"I had been questioning him about you for 10 years, every time I could, in every way, from every angle." "No, he did not tell me. It was the way he spoke of you that did. He didn't want to speak, but he spoke too eagerly, eagerly and reluctantly together. And then I knew that it had not been just a childhood friendship. I knew how much he had given up for the strike, and how desperately he hadn't given it up forever. I was merely questioning him about one of our most important future strikers, as I questioned him about many others." The hint of derision remained in his eyes. He knew that she had wanted to hear this, but that this was not the answer to the one question she feared. She looked from his face to Francisco's approaching figure, not hiding from herself any longer that her sudden, heavy, desolate anxiety was the fear that Gault might throw the three of them into the hopeless waste of self-sacrifice. Francisco approached, looking at her thoughtfully, as if weighing some question of his own, but some question that gave a sparkle of reckless gaiety to his eyes.
"Dagny, there's only 1 week left," he said. "If you decide to go back, it will be the last for a long time."
There was no reproach and no sadness in his voice, only some softened quality as sole evidence of emotion.
"If you leave now—"
"Oh yes, you'll still come back, but it won't be soon. And I, in a few months, I'll come to live here permanently.
So if you go, I won't see you again, perhaps for years. I'd like you to spend this last week with me. I'd like you to move to my house. As my guest, nothing else, for no reason, except that I'd like you to. He said it simply, as if nothing were or could be hidden among the three of them. She saw no sign of astonishment in Galt's face. She felt some swift tightening in her chest, something hard, reckless, and almost vicious that had the quality of a dark excitement driving her blindly into action. "But I'm an employee," she said, with an odd smile, looking at Galt. "I have a job to finish." "I won't hold you to it," said Galt, and she felt anger at the tone of his voice, a tone that granted her no hidden significance and answered nothing but the literal meaning of her words. "You can quit the job any time you wish. It's up to you." "No, it isn't. I'm a prisoner here. Don't you remember? I'm to take orders. I have no preferences to follow, no wishes to express, no decisions to make. I want the decision to be yours."
"You want it to be mine?"
"Yes."
"You've expressed a wish." The mockery of his voice was in its seriousness, and she threw at him defiantly, not smiling, as if daring him to continue pretending that he did not understand.
"All right. That's what I wish."
He smiled, as at a child's complex scheming which he had long since seen through. "Very well." But he did not smile as he said, turning to Francisco, "Then, no." The defiance toward an adversary who was the sternest of teachers was all that Francisco had read in her face. He shrugged, regretfully, but gaily. "You're probably right. If you can't prevent her from going back, nobody can." She was not hearing Francisco's words. She was stunned by the magnitude of the relief that hit her at the sound of Galt's answer, a relief that told her the magnitude of the fear it swept away. She knew, only after it was over, what had hung for her on his decision. She knew that had his answer been different, it would have destroyed the valley in her eyes. She wanted to laugh. She wanted to embrace them both and laugh with them in celebration. It did not seem to matter whether she would stay here or return to the world. A week was like an endless span of time. Either course seemed flooded by an unchanging sunlight. And no struggle was hard, she thought, if this was the nature of existence. The relief did not come from the knowledge that he would not renounce her, nor from any assurance that she would win. The relief came from the certainty that he would always remain what he was. "I don't know whether I'll go back to the world or not," she said soberly, but her voice was trembling with a subdued violence which was pure gaiety. "I'm sorry that I'm still unable to make a decision. I'm certain of only one thing, that I won't be afraid to decide." Francisco took the sudden brightness of her face as proof that the incident had been of no significance. But Galt understood. He glanced at her, and the glance was part amusement, part contemptuous reproach. He said nothing until they were alone, walking down the trail to the valley. Then he glanced at her again, the amusement sharper in his eyes, and said, "You had to put me to a test in order to learn whether I'd fall to the lowest possible stage of altruism." She did not answer, but looked at him in open, undefensive admission. He chuckled and looked away, and a few steps later said slowly, in the tone of a quotation, "Nobody stays here by faking reality in any manner whatever." Part of the intensity of her relief, she thought, as she walked silently by his side, was the shock of a contrast. She had seen, with the sudden, immediate vividness of sensory perception, an exact picture of what the code of self-sacrifice would have meant if enacted by the three of them. Galt, giving up the woman he wanted for the sake of his friend, faking his greatest feeling out of existence and himself out of her life, no matter what the cost to him and to her, then dragging the rest of his years through the waste of the unreached and unfulfilled. She, turning for consolation to a second choice, faking a love she did not feel, being willing to fake, since her will to self-deceit was the essential required for Galt's self-sacrifice, then living out her years in hopeless longing, accepting, as relief for an unhealing wound, some moments of weary affection, plus the tenet that love is futile and happiness is not to be found on earth. Francisco, struggling in the elusive fog of a counterfeit reality, his life a fraud staged by the two who were dearest to him and most trusted, struggling to grasp what was missing from his happiness, struggling down the brittle scaffold of a lie over the abyss of the discovery that he was not the man she loved, but only a resented substitute, half-charity patient, half-crutch, his perceptiveness becoming his danger, and only his surrender to lethargic stupidity protecting the shoddy structure of his joy, struggling and giving up and settling into the dreary routine of the conviction that fulfillment is impossible to man. The three of them, who had had all the gifts of existence spread out before them, ending up as embittered hulks, who cry in despair that life is frustration, the frustration of not being able to make unreality real. But this, she thought, was men's moral code in the outer world, a code that told them to act on the premise of one another's weakness, deceit, and stupidity. And this was the pattern of their lives, this struggle through a fog of the pretended and unacknowledged, this belief that facts are not solid or final, this state where, denying any form to reality, men stumble through life, unreal and unformed, and die having never been born. Here, she thought, looking down through green branches at the glittering roofs of the valley, one dealt with men as clear and firm as sun and rocks, and the immense light-heartedness of her relief came from the knowledge that no battle was hard, no decision was dangerous where there was no soggy uncertainty, no shapeless evasion to encounter. "Did it ever occur to you, Miss Taggart," said Galt, in the casual tone of an abstract discussion, but as if he had known her thoughts, "that there is no conflict of interests among men, neither in business, nor in trade, nor in their most personal desires. If they omit the irrational from their view of the possible, and destruction from their view of the practical, there is no conflict, and no call for sacrifice, and no man is a threat to the aims of another. If men understand that reality is an absolute not to be faked, that lies do not work, that the unearned cannot be had, that the undeserved cannot be given, that the destruction of a value which is will not bring value to that which isn't. The businessman who wishes to gain a market by throttling a superior competitor, the worker who wants a share of his employer's wealth, the artist who envies a rival's higher talent, they're all wishing facts out of existence, and destruction is the only means of their wish. If they pursue it, they will not achieve a market, a fortune, or an immortal fame. They will merely destroy production, employment, and art. A wish for the irrational is not to be achieved, whether the sacrificial victims are willing or not. But men will not cease to desire the impossible, and will not lose their longing to destroy, so long as self-destruction and self-sacrifice are preached to them as the practical means of achieving the happiness of the recipients. He glanced at her and added slowly, a slight emphasis as sole change in the impersonal tone of his voice, "No one's happiness but my own is in my power to achieve or to destroy. You should have had more respect for him and for me than to fear what you had feared." She did not answer. She felt as if a word would overfill the fullness of this moment. She merely turned to him with a look of acquiescence that was disarmed, childishly humble, and would have been an apology but for its shining joy. He smiled, in amusement, in understanding, almost in comradeship of the things they shared, and in sanction of the things she felt. They went on in silence, and it seemed to her that this was a summer day out of a carefree youth she had never lived. It was just a walk through the country by two people who were free for the pleasure of motion and sunlight, with no unsolved burdens left to carry. her sense of lightness blended with the weightless sense of walking downhill, as if she needed no effort to walk, only to restrain herself from flying, and she walked, fighting the speed of the downward pull, her body leaning back, the wind blowing her skirt like a sail to break her motion. They parted at the bottom of the trail. He went to keep an appointment with Midas Mulligan, while she went to Hammond's Market with a list of items for the evening's dinner as the sole concern of her world. His wife, she thought, letting herself hear consciously the word Dr. Exton had not pronounced, the word she had long since felt but never named. For 3 weeks she had been his wife in every sense but one, and that final one was still to be earned. But this much was real, and today she could permit herself to know it, to feel it, to live with that one thought for this one day. The groceries, which Lawrence Hammond was lining up at her order on the polished counter of his store, had never appeared to her as such shining objects, and intent upon them she was only half-conscious of some disturbing element, of something that was wrong, but that her mind was too full to notice. She noticed it only when she saw Hammond pause, frown, and stare upward at the sky beyond his open storefront. In time with his words, "I think somebody's trying to repeat your stunt, Miss Taggart," she realized that it was the sound of an airplane overhead, and that it had been there for some time, a sound which was not to be heard in the valley after the first of this month. They rushed out to the street. The small silver cross of a plane was circling above the ring of mountains, like a sparkling dragonfly about to brush the peaks with its wings. "What does he think he's doing?" said Lawrence Hammond. There were people at the doors of the shops and standing still all down the street, looking up. "Is anyone expected?" she asked, and was astonished by the anxiety of her own voice. "No," said Hammond. "Everyone who's got any business here is here." He did not sound disturbed, but grimly curious. The plane was now a small dash, like a silver cigarette, streaking against the flanks of the mountains. It had dropped lower. "Looks like a private monoplane," said Hammond, squinting against the sun. "Not an army model." "Will the ray screen hold out?" she asked tensely, in a tone of defensive resentment against the approach of an enemy. He chuckled. "Hold out? Will he see us?" "That screen is safer than an underground vault, Miss Taggart, as you ought to know." The plane rose, and for a moment it was only a bright speck, like a bit of paper blown by the wind. It hovered uncertainly, then dropped down again into another circling spiral. "What in hell is he after?" said Hammond. Her eyes shot suddenly to his face. "He's looking for something," said Hammond. "What?"
"Is there a telescope somewhere?"
"Why, yes, at the airfield, but—" He was about to ask what was the matter with her voice, but she was running across the road, down the path to the airfield, not knowing that she was running, driven by a reason she had no time and no courage to name. She found Dwight Sanders at the small telescope of the control tower. He was watching the plane attentively, with a puzzled frown.
"Let me see it," she snapped.
She clutched the metal tube. She pressed her eye to the lens, her hand guiding the tube slowly to follow the plane. Then he saw that her hand had stopped, but her fingers did not open, and her face remained bent over the telescope, pressed to the lens, until he looked closer and saw that the lens was pressed to her forehead. "What's the matter, Miss Taggart?" She raised her head slowly. "Is it anyone you know, Miss Taggart?" She did not answer. She hurried away, her steps rushing with the zigzagging aimlessness of uncertainty. She dared not run, but she had to escape. She had to hide. She did not know whether she was afraid to be seen by the men around her or by the plane above, the plane whose silver wings bore the number that belonged to Hank Reardon. She stopped when she stumbled over a rock and fell and noticed that she had been running. She was on a small ledge in the cliffs above the airfield, hidden from the sight of the town, open to the view of the sky. She rose, her hands groping for support along a granite wall, feeling the warmth of the sun on the rock under her palms. She stood, her back pressed to the wall, unable to move or to take her eyes off the plane. The plane was circling slowly, dipping down, then rising again, struggling, she thought, as she had struggled, to distinguish the site of a wreck in a hopeless spread of crevices and boulders, an elusive spread neither clear enough to abandon nor to survey. He was searching for the wreck of her plane. He had not given up, and whatever the 3 weeks of it had cost him, whatever he felt, the only evidence he would give to the world and his only answer was this steady, insistent, monotonous drone of a motor carrying a fragile craft over every deadly foot of an inaccessible chain of mountains. Through the brilliant purity of the summer air, the plane seemed intimately close. She could see it rock on precarious currents and bank under the thrusts of wind. She could see, and it seemed impossible that so clear a sight was closed to his eyes. The whole of the valley lay below him, flooded by sunlight, flaming with glass panes and green lawns, screaming to be seen.